of what many Western leaders believed about Adolf Hitler in the early 1930s. After all, if you examine the German New Deal, you will find striking similarities with the American New Deal. In fact, it might surprise you to know that Winston Churchill once said, "If England ever finds herself in as desperate a straits as Germany, I hope that England finds her own Adolf Hitler." In fact, it might amuse you also to know that Adolf Hitler wrote Franklin Roosevelt a letter commending him on his economic policies. After all, what were the hallmarks of the German Nazi system? Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, public schooling, trade restrictions, immigration controls. You see, but this is part of the life of the lie. Because Americans believe, as a result of what they learn in public schools, that all of these things came from Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Locke. They think Americans have always had these things. They have no idea that these programs came from the Iron Chancellor of Germany, Otto von Bismarck, who himself had taken them from the German socialists. Hitler said to Roosevelt, "I want to commend you on recognizing that the private interests of the individual must be sacrificed for the greater good of society." The reason that this is so pertinent today with respect to what Hayek was warning us about 50 years ago was what is happening in Cuba today. My friends, 30 years ago, 60,000 of my generation were sent to their deaths in one of these foreign wars in Southeast Asia, some of my schoolmates. And I remember what they told us as the body bags were coming back on a daily basis, that it was all there so that they, because it would be terrible for people to fight, to suffer under communism. We needed to save the South Vietnamese from having to suffer under communism. Apparently it wasn't that important when they turned Eastern Europe over to Stalin and the communists. But now all of a sudden it was. As if it had nothing to do with the profits that were being made by the military-industrial complex. And the sham of it all, the deception, is exposed 30 years later. Because today you have U.S. military personnel working mano a mano with Cuban communist Coast Guard officials in the forcible repatriation of Cuban refugees back into communist tyranny. And this is the support of both Democrats and Republicans in the United States. In other words, U.S. military personnel locate refugees. They put them on the Coast Guard vessel. They take an M16 with a bayonet. They radio their Cuban communist Coast Guard comrades. The two boats unite and they push and shove these women, these children, onto these Cuban communist vessels for forcible repatriation. You know when that plane was shot down? Do you know what that plane was doing up there recently? They were locating Cuban refugee boats. Now you don't hear about this. To ask the boats, "Do you want us to report your position to U.S. Coast Guard officials?" They wanted to give them a choice because they know that if they go to the Coast Guard, they immediately are returned to communism. This is the mindset that Hayek was talking about. The totalitarian evil mindset that sees nothing wrong with any of this. And as many of you know, this is not the first experience that Americans have had with repatriation. There was a time when Adolf Hitler... Now, you don't learn about this in American public schools, where they have the government-approved school teachers teaching government-approved doctrine. Adolf Hitler offered to let all German Jews out of Germany alive if any country would take them. Franklin Roosevelt's response, the great humanitarian, the person who every single student in every single public school in America is taught was America's greatest president, the lover of the poor, said, no German Jew will enter America because they'll just take jobs away from America. If you don't believe this, visit the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. They have an entire section as to what the State Department of the United States' response was to Heir Hitler. In fact, there's a famous story. There's a movie called The Voyage of the Damned, where there was a cruise ship coming from Germany to Havana Harbor, filled with German Jews. The Cuban authorities would not permit them to disembark. The ship started moving toward Miami Harbor, and the State Department sent out the order, no German Jew was to jump ship. They felt they might pollute American shores. See, that's what always amuses me about these welfare statists. They always love the poor. They love the needy. They love the disadvantaged. Fight a public housing project. Have a conference like this, and what's the first thing they say? You hate the poor. You're a racist. But what's always amazing is when you ask these lovers of the poor, how come they favor immigration controls, especially on the southern border? Why do they want to build a wall similar to the Berlin Wall? And they say, we have too many people in California. You say, oh, that's all there is to it? Yes, yes, that's all there is. Well, then I suppose you favor population control. No, no, don't put words in my mouth. Well, look, but if births exceed deaths by 3 million, that's just the same as 3 million Mexicans coming in. Don't put words in my mouth. Well, then I suppose you favor immigration controls between the respective states of the Union. People from Idaho and Montana certainly shouldn't be moving into California. No, that's not what I mean. The truth is that they don't believe these people are desirable people. If they believed they were desirable people, these Mexicans, these Guatemalans, these Haitians, these Cubans, they would say, bring them all in. It's only when you believe something is undesirable. But it is only the libertarians who are standing the moral high ground. My friends, this has been a century of darkness, a century of socialism, a century of communism, of the welfare state, the planned economy, the regulated society, whatever you want to call it, the society of the omnipotent government. The state is everywhere. But there has been one beacon of light through this darkness. And that beacon has belonged to us libertarians. I would like to share with you a story that is one of the most moving stories I've ever heard. It is a story of courage. It is a story of principle. It is a story of honor. It is the story of the White Rose. In Nazi Germany, in the beginning, most Germans supported what Hitler was doing. Massive government spending, regulations, bringing Germany back. And included among these many Germans who were supporting this idea were a brother and sister named Hans and Sophie Scholl. Their parents warned them that Germany was on the wrong track. But these were two college students, very idealistic. And they joined the Hitler Youth. They supported the Hitler programs. But gradually they began realizing that all this was wrong. They began having debates with their friends and one of their professors. And once war broke out, they realized how horrible things had come. And so they got together, a few of them, and began publishing libertarian essays. They were using a secret mimeograph machine. They were buying postage in small quantities. And all of a sudden, the White Rose, these essays, began popping up in various parts of Germany. It was the first time the dissent had reached the surface in Germany. The Gestapo was going crazy. People were looking at it, circulating it. One day, while they were distributing leaflets at the University of Munich, Hans and Sophie Scholl's luck ran out. And they were arrested by the Gestapo. Berlin sent down a judge within 3 days to have their trial. And the judge ranted and raved at the trial against them as well as their best friend, Christoph Probst, who was also about 22 or 23. How could you do this? Don't you know what patriotism means? You were educated in public schools. You came from nice families, and they did. Once the shooting starts, it's time to rally around the flag, the judge said. Support the troops. Sophie Scholl, this 21-year-old, very attractive girl, stands up and says to this judge, ranting and raving at her, "Somebody had to make the start. German integrity demanded it." The three of them were sentenced to death. That afternoon, the parents of Hans and Mary and Sophie Scholl came and visited them in the prison. And Sophie's mother says to her, "Oh, Sophie, Sophie, to think that you never will be coming through the front door again." And Sophie responds, "Oh, mother, such a short time. But perhaps what we have done here will serve as a model for people who come after us." That evening, the prison guards were so impressed with the courage and the calm and the bravery of these young people that they violated prison regulations in the Nazi state and permitted the three of them to have one last smoke together and to say goodbye to one another, these three friends. Sophie Scholl leads her brother to the guillotine. She is beheaded. Her brother reaches the door of the guillotine room, turns around into the courtyard and yells, "Long live freedom!" And he is beheaded. And then their best friend, Christoph Probst, who had just had his third child and whose wife did not even know he had been arrested, tried, and executed, was beheaded. My friends, it would be highly unusual if any of us ever were placed in that position for the sake of our principles. What we have to face is something significantly less as libertarians. Social ostracism, name-calling, loneliness. But what has always characterized libertarians as compared to everyone else in the world is the commitment to principle, the commitment to integrity. Regardless of whether some of us are working to roll back the state 25%, 50%, or those of us that are working in the more radical paradigm, all of us agree on the same goal. And that given the opportunity to achieve that goal, every libertarian will go for it. This is what separates us. Every one of you can point to the time in your life where you broke through. That's when I saw what inflation was. That's when I saw what government was doing. You have reached a higher level of consciousness. You are the light. You are the John Galtz. You are the Dagny Taggarts. You are the Francisco de Acuñas. You are the Dominic Francons. You are the Howard Roarks. You are the Hank Reardons. This has been a century of darkness, but when the history of the 20th century is ultimately written, who can doubt that it will be the libertarians who are leading the world out of this darkness? At the risk of sounding nationalistic, I have absolutely no doubt that the Americans are going to stop the world dead in its tracks, and the world is going to turn and look at all in awe as we dismantle the entire edifice of the socialistic welfare state. But that's what competition is all about. What greater event could you participate in than to be the pioneer in your country leading the world out of this darkness? If we maintain our commitment to principles, if we maintain the purity of our ideals, it shall be the libertarians who lead the world out of this darkness, out of this socialistic morass, and up onward to the highest reaches of freedom ever seen by man. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bumper. How many of you need to take a break? Say aye. Okay, before you go, one little thing. There on every table, there are some surveys for those of you who didn't get an opportunity to give us your feedback on the conference. If you do have a few minutes during the break, just fill one out and drop it in this box right here. And that'll help us to make sure that the conventions just keep getting better year after year, just like this one is. Okay, we'll take a 15-minute break, and then come on back. The bar is open. Those of you who have display tables in the main room, you have two choices. You can either come in as early as 7:30 tomorrow morning. It doesn't mean you have to be here at 7:30, but the staff will open up at 7:30. And you can remove your tables then, or you can do it now. So just so that you know, you'll be able to get into the hall at 7:30 tomorrow morning. Shh. We have a quick announcement to make. Okay, Jim just asked me to make an announcement, too. Those of you who are ordering tapes of tonight's session, just a second, just to make sure you hear the announcements. Those of you who are ordering tapes want a tape of Bumper's session tonight. The duplication will be going on while the auction is taking place, so you'll actually be able to pick up your tapes here at the table on the upper level before you leave, okay? In fact, anybody else who has tapes ordered, they'll probably be there for pickup too, but Bumpers will be ready already tonight. Okay, we have another quick announcement. There are still a few people who either need rides or have space going back to Vancouver Airport tomorrow morning, and Tunya's just going to take a minute and let you know what's cooking there.
About rides to Vancouver tomorrow, we've pretty well matched everybody. Anybody still need a ride tomorrow to Vancouver area, please see me and we'll try and match you before the end of the auction. Those people who are going to be riding with Christopher Albright in his van, he still has room for one or two more. These people are to be meeting in the lobby of Blackcomb Lodge at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Another big need is that Barbara Brandon would like a ride on Monday. That's not tomorrow, Monday, to be at the airport by about 4 p.m. So please see me if you have extra space to take somebody or if you still have a need to get lifted to Vancouver. Thanks.
Thank you. Ready to roll? Okay. Here we go with the auction, and Wayne Marsden will be the auctioneer tonight. And Bruce Evoy, where are you, Bruce? Could you just stand up for 1 second and wave to people? Bruce Evoy is in the center. He'll be keeping track of the bids and collecting the money. You can either pay as you go or run a tab and pay at the end, but there are big, tough guards at the door waiting for you. All right, so you can pay as you go, and Borka is going to be helping him. There will also be some assistance for Wayne to locate the people who are making the bids so we can move this along very quickly. 1 second. Okay, ready to begin? Wayne Marsden.
All right, bring in that first batch of calves. What was that? It was an auction, right? What's this? Another piece. All right. Uh-oh, there goes my man. He's running up. We've got spotters on either side of the gallery here to identify successful bidders and relay that information down to Bruce. So we're going to try to do this with some dispatch and enough amusement to keep it rolling. And have we got a first item to be auctioned? Start us off with something easy.
First of seven bottles.
Okay, first of seven bottles of Chateau Isle 1996. The way we'll do this, we'll bid for the first bottle. We'll bid for the first bottle, and then the people have the right, the first few people to get their hands up have the right to match at the same price as a successful bidder. This is how it's normally done, and we have seven bottles. Is that correct, Marco? Seven bottles. All right, how about an opening bid of $10 for a nice, keepable bottle of Isle 96? We got a $10 bid. Do I hear 11? We got 10. We got 10 going once.
Oh, first of all, are we bidding in Canadian or American?
These dollars? Are all U.S. dollars. These are U.S. dollars, and for those of us lucky enough to have Canadian cash, we get to pay $1.30 for a U.S. dollar. So bear that in mind when you're bidding. Well, this is Chateau Isle 96 Pinot Noir, Whistler, B.C. It's got the Isle crest, and it's a beautiful British Columbia wine. So we've got a $10 bid. Do we hear 11? I got 11. 11. Do I have 12? We've got 11. 11 once? 11 twice? We got 12. I have 12. We have seven bottles, but they're going to... The person who... But we, the, when the...